welcome to a special edition of Faithless Brewing. I am Dan Schriever, also known as Cave Dan Online, coming to you live from Durham, North Carolina, and I am joined by my guy on the left coast. He is Damon Alexander. Damon, what's up?
Hey, I don't think we're really live in the sense that this is released long after our words are spoken right now, but yeah, I'm doing good. Glad to be here.
I'm just trying to give like people the live experience so they can imagine that I'm right here.
Oh, okay.
From my office into your living room, something like that. No, it's the podcasting experience. It's 2020. We're doing it. It's great. No David Robinson today, but we do have a very special guest, also from the left coast, all the way from Santa Cruz, California. It's Brian Madden. Brian, how are you?
I'm not too bad. Going well, all things told. Fires, lots of smoke, but holding strong.
Yeah, you were right in the thick of the wildfires.
Yeah, pretty close. Very, very fortunate. Have a bunch of friends and coworkers who have had to be evacuated. Know some people who lost their houses, but I am safe and sound where I'm at.
Yeah, covered in a thin layer of ash, nice and cozy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is some scary stuff.
Yeah, I am. I'm slowly turning into a smoked sausage here. Is what's going on.
But now that we've handled how is Brian, I guess the next question is, who is Brian?
Yeah, listeners to our cast will have heard us mention Brian a few times as the mastermind of our community league, our Faithless Brewing Community League. So Brian is a member, a key member of the Faithless family writ large. But Brian, why don't you tell us a little bit more about sort of who you are as a Magic player? Help us get to know you a little bit.
Yeah, so on the Discord, I have a little tag after my name, Artificer, and that's because I have found that I am very drawn to artifact piles and the world of crazy combo lines that comes with those artifacts. I've been playing now for a couple of years. I had played back in like 94, 95-ish time frame, and as most people do, kind of fall out of it. Got back into it a few years ago and kind of floated around, thought I was interested in control decks for a little while. I like the idea of sort of bending the game rules or doing things that manipulate the game rules. And last year, about a year ago now, actually, fell in love with the Wurza deck right before Oko made his appearance into the deck. I like the toolbox nature of it, and I've been kind of playing with artifact piles ever since, trying to make them work in every format that I play.
So right before Oko hit, so this was when, I guess, was Hogak still legal, or was this after Hogak?
Hogak was still legal. It was like maybe July, August of last year.
Okay, so you were about that Ensnaring Bridge or were for Grafdigger's Cage, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Still have basically that same version of the deck sleeved up. I was sadly flipping through it the other day. I don't know if I could ever get rid of Ensnaring Bridge out of my 75. It's just so good. When it's great, it's great.
Yeah, it's sad to think of all the cards we've lost in this time period. Not sad about Hogak or Oko, but just thinking about Opal. Opal's gone. Looting's gone. They're not coming back.
When it looked like Opal was going to get banned, I was like, that's not really going to be a major setback. I'm not too worried about it. And I think that the deck still had some legs after the loss of Opal, but with Astrolabe getting banned, sad days. And my other sort of interest, even while I was playing Wurza, I was working on Assault Loam lists, and they were very big fans of Faithless Looting. So the looting ban, also sad days.
Sometimes I wonder about how the first few turns of Magic are so critical, and they really have this very integer basis where it's like one land drop a turn, Astrolabe, you draw one card for one mana. And if there was a way to have Mox Opal cost half a mana and Astrolabe draw you half a card, these would be perfectly good cards. They'd let these decks continue functioning. But somehow, just the fact that you're either zero or one or two, just Mox Opal just sits in this realm where I feel like there's no way to have it be fair or totally broken. And I'm personally happy it's gone, although I'm sad for all my friends who miss it so dearly.
I think you've just invented something, actually. If we just flip a coin when the card ETBs, there's how you sometimes get your draw, you know?
Isn't that Hearthstone? I've never played it, but my understanding is they have all sorts of effects like this.
I couldn't tell you.
So fractional mana. So integers was a problem the whole time, right? We just don't have enough casting costs or, you know, draw half a card. Is that what you're saying to him?
I know. And as a mathematician, you can't even take derivatives properly.
I don't even know what to say to that. Magic's in 2020. There you go. okay, so lost Urza decks, lost Opal decks. What about in terms of like as a deck builder or a brewer, sort of does that mean that you're also still interested in primarily the artifact space, or do you have a more expansive palette?
I definitely have a more expansive palette. I, like I said, I think that I'm interested in things that sort of bend the rules or, you know, just are really bizarre cards. Like I'm drawn to things. For example, one of the brew around cards for one of our leagues was Braid of Fire. I saw that card and I was like, wait, so you get to add mana as a part of your upkeep. Why is this a cost? Like, what is this card doing? Things like that, or cards that really ask you to sort of solve a mini game or a puzzle, you know, to meet their conditions. Those are always really interesting because especially when you talk about eternal formats, you know, the card pool starts to grow and then there's ways to sort of circumvent the assumptions that were made when that card was designed. So I don't know. I have a whole list of things that are really interesting to me because they do just like wacky things. And a lot of those tend to be artifacts, but not always. You know, if I find something that's an enchantment or a creature that sort of meets those criteria and I think is like bizarre, definitely going to try and play it. I think Kinnan is actually a really great example of a newer card that fits that bill. I'm really interested in activating his activated ability. Like his mana production is something that's really obvious, but I want to know how I can abuse that activated ability. So I've definitely dabbled in some things there. And yeah,
I think just from like a design perspective, when you hear like a tournament player talking about, you know, this or that card that's so key to their deck, and then they mention that, oh, it also has like trinket text at the end that just is irrelevant, you know, we never use the second and third abilities of this card or something, I mean, I accept that from a competitive standpoint, but it's also like a little bit unsatisfying. Like you wish that the entire package were somehow important, you know.
Yep.
Like Kinnan making mana and then using that mana to pour it into the activated ability, which is like right there on the card. That would be so great. So maybe this is a good segue to talk a little bit about some of these brew rounds and talk a little bit about the league. So you have been sort of administering this league, not only administering it, but sort of coming up with just a tremendous creativity in terms of like what we do. For those not familiar with it, why don't you give a quick intro to what is the Community League?
Yeah, so the Community League is, they've been so far run as 4-week sort of league style play. We do 2 matches per week, and basically anybody who signs up will just get paired up against somebody else in the league. 2 different people each week. They play their matches anytime during the week and then submit results. I do pairings based on points as best I can, although sometimes things don't work out and you get some wacky pairings. But you know, the idea is really just to kind of have more of an FNM feel to things. You know, I was primarily a paper player. I had done a little bit of MTGO when the pandemic hit. And I really prefer the social aspect, the in-person aspect of playing in paper. So, you know, I was really missing that. Somebody else on the Discord had sort of brought up the idea or mentioned that I think the Dive Down was doing something similar. And, you know, they said, hey, we should do this. And everybody kind of agreed that it was a good idea. And I have a tendency towards action. So I just put out a little survey to see, you know, how many people were actually interested in participating. The first survey, I think I had 45 or 50 responses. So I just decided to kind of run with it and see what would happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a huge hit, I think. And just think about the things that have come out of this unexpected year, the year of our Lord, COVID-19. I mean, when paper play dried up, I hear what you're saying. I recently moved. I put all my cards in boxes and they have not left those boxes. They're just like in a closet right now. I don't know if they're going to leave those boxes for months. I'm sure there are stores, but I don't think they're holding events. The beating heart of Magic for a lot of people, you know, what I think of as like the thing that keeps me engaged, not just at an intellectual level, but like at a very interpersonal communal level, is, you know, going to the store, or going to the LGS on Fridays or Saturdays or something. That's just evaporated. And finding ways to like fill that with something that's more than just playing with, you know, the anonymous league opponent on Magic Online or Arena has made such a huge difference, I think. Adds a whole nother layer to the game because it feels like it's more like a shared experience, you know, even if it's playing against someone who I only know a little bit through just chatting with them on the Discord. Even that is huge, like the difference between 0 and 1.
Yep, absolutely.
Which I'm told by mathematicians that's a big difference. So.
Yeah, I mean, just having a friendly nameplate on the other end there is you know, it's it makes everything just a little bit better. You know, every match that I've been involved in, there's been friendly banter. Sometimes we hop on Discord voice chat and talk while we're playing. You know, I've been kind of trying to stream some of my games in the Discord. And so sometimes we get some people in there viewing and commenting at the same time. And, you know, it just it definitely brings a lot of that community feel, a lot of the gathering back to Magic the Gathering.
Well said. So, yeah, I think what we'd like to do in our time today is just sort of highlight some of the cool, interesting lists. Obviously, not everyone is able to play in these leagues, whether just because of time zones or they don't play online or they're not part of our Discord. But hey, if you're interested in playing with us, of course, feel free to join and sign up. We'd love to have you. But I think it'd be a nice opportunity to talk through some of the cool lists that have come out of these leagues and highlight some of the potential we see in some of these deck concepts, maybe kick some ideas around for ways we might develop them in the future.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's just dive into it. I think, Brian, you picked out some lists that caught your eye from the most recent community league.
Oh, yeah. So in the first week of our second league, we had a brew round restriction that used any of the Brewer's Choice cards that had been nominated for the Brewer's Choice episodes. And I ended up facing up against Judge Rob from the Discord. He had a really cool deck, I thought, that used Sundial of the Infinite. And Sundial, both being an artifact and having a really unique ability, has always been interesting to me in the first place. But I think he did a really good job of finding ways to exploit that effect. So he was playing cards like Hunted Horror and Necroplasm. And so he could do things like activate the Sundial in response to the Hunted Horror trigger to keep it. Or he could use the Necroplasm as a conditional board wipe when it was convenient for him. Or he could just kind of end his turn with the trigger on the stack if it wasn't convenient. And I thought that was a really neat interaction.
Something tells me these cards are readers. I hear Damon frantically typing into the Scryfall search, Necroplasm, Hunted Horror. You don't hear these words very often. What are these cards? Hunted Horror, black for a 7/7 trample. My goodness, 7/7 for 2. When it enters the battlefield, you create 2/3/3 green centaur creature tokens with protection from black under an opponent's control. So the centaurs, I guess, are hunting this.
It was enough of a reader that I even forgot what it did and said that he got to keep it by using the Sundial trigger.
Right. So if you don't have the Sundial, you can just play this. You'll get a 7/7, they'll get 2/3/3s, and I think they come out a little bit ahead of that exchange. But if you do have the Sundial, you know, for an extra mana, you just get your cheap 7/7 trample. The Necroplasm, gosh, this is the forgotten dredge card. So this is a dredge 2 creature, 1 black for a 1/1. At the beginning of your upkeep, put a +1/+1 counter on Necroplasm. Then at the beginning of your end step, destroy each creature with converted mana cost equal to the number of +1/+1 counters on Necroplasm. So I guess if you're thinking the typical sequence would be, it takes 3 turns for this to kill itself?
Mm-hmm.
It eventually does like engineered explosives on itself. But if you can somehow get around that with a Sundial, you're talking about just sort of keeping it around indefinitely or controlling sort of where its power and toughness sits.
Yeah, and you know, if you have something like the Hunted Horror out, it means that you can keep the horror alive, you know, on 2 if you need to, or, you know, kind of skip any number of wipes that you would want to skip. Because, I mean, killing itself on three, I guess it does grow larger, but it is only a 1-1, so I would rather have my hunted horror at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not so sure about keeping it at a given power toughness, Dan, in the sense that you have to do it on your upkeep, activate your sundial, so you just lose your whole turn, which doesn't seem like a path to victory. But that said, there's like a cool interaction here that just is independent of sundial, and that's if you play hunted horror on two, you get a 7-7, your opponent gets two creatures with zero CMC, and you play a necroplasm on three, and those die at end of turn. And so the EE on zero you get immediately kind of undoes the hunted horror, or the hunting of the horror.
Yeah, I actually had missed that one at first. That's a nice little curve out backup plan.
Yeah, so all three of those interact with each other in positive ways, which is pretty sweet. The sundial, the hunted horror, and the necroplasm. Talk to me about Ideas Unbound.
Ah, yeah. So that's a draw three and then discard three at the end of turn for two blue. And so the interaction there with the sundial is pretty nice. You can draw your three cards if, you know, that's what you're looking to do. And then at the end step, you can activate the sundial so that you don't have to discard. And I actually thought that this was an interesting card with sundial and maybe a different shell, because there may be instances where, you know, discarding can be good. And so having the option of either discarding or not seems like that could be a pretty neat interaction to explore.
Yeah, the key to me with decks like this is basically you have this deck built around Sundial of the Infinite. And so how do you create redundancy? Because unfortunately, you only have four of this effect in Modern. We'll discuss another deck that plays Torp Orb for a similar effect. But obviously, that doesn't work with Ideas Unbound at all. And so the question is, how do you take advantage or capitalize on the games where you don't draw the build around card? And so, yeah, using Ideas Unbound with a natural graveyard synergy is one idea. Necroplasm plus Haunted Horror to clear the 3-3 centaurs is another one. And so kind of I always try to keep an eye out for ways to build this redundancy into the deck.
Yeah, so discontinuity does a little bit of that role, but I think just the way that Ideas Unbound works on both axes, like you're saying, Brian, is so clever. I mean, there's a whole reanimation angle. There's four unearths here. There's also a couple of key to the city to provide additional ways to get creatures into the graveyard. Rotting Registrar is a discard outlet. There's even some rotting rats. So it's really some tight packages here for both like getting a quick board presence, playing out of the graveyard, but also potentially getting some nice card advantage. So it's a pretty cool take on Sundial and a change from, like, you know, I think I've talked about on the pod before, a Sundial deck where it was mainly built around the Theros Titans, Kroxa and Uro, just trying to get those triggers on the stack and then end the turn that way. This doesn't play any Titans, which I think is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty close to a mono black list, actually. I kind of wonder if the reason to go into blue was for the mystical disputes in the sideboard, to be honest. I discontinuity is a nice backup plan if you don't have the sundial, but with the other synergies, you know, in the deck, I don't know that the discontinuity is even that necessary. Maybe he was going for the Ideas Unbound synergies, but I don't know. You'd have to ask him.
Yeah, I guess you could swap out the blue and play Kroxa if you wanted to just do that instead. I wouldn't hate that.
I mean, I'm sure Judge Rob was metagaming with the Mystical Disputes over Aether Gust, just taking a clean read on our meta that we have more blue players than red-green players, even though Aether Gust is, in my opinion, the premier blue sideboard card these days.
I think it's just that Judge Rob is a diehard Ponza player at heart. He's a stalwart of the Ponza subreddit. He has played a lot of nasty pillage decks in his day, and I'm sure he hates seeing Aether Gust on the other side of the battlefield.
Won't put it in any of his lists, just on principle.
Exactly. All right, so you mentioned a Torpor Orb list, Damon. What do we have here?
Yeah, so this is a Grixis Torpor Orb coming from Dr. Huckleberry, and this is actually coming from our first community league, but I think there's a lot of interesting lessons and comparisons to the deck from Judge Rob. And so this one features a Sundial of the Infinite, and also Torpor Orb is actually the primary combo piece, and Sundial is more of the slightly not as good effect as Torpor Orb, because this deck leans heavily on the creatures and doesn't use things like Ideas Unbound. And so what creatures does it use? Well, Vexing Devil is just a one red mana for a 4-3 with a Torpor Orb out. Kroxa is red-black for a 6-6 with an attack trigger that's quite good. And meanwhile, we have these Hunted Horrors and Treacherous Pit Dweller, which I will have to admit I do have to look up this one. I forget offhand. And also, As an additional piece of redundancy, some Lazav the Multifarious, who can be used after you play your Kroxa without a Torpor Orb out, to just kind of copy it and then have a 6-6 the other way.
Yeah, Treacherous Pit Dweller is the hidden undying creature, 4-3 for just black-black. And with undying, it comes back as a 5-4, which is great, you know, all that for 2 mana, except that when it comes back from the graveyard, it then marches over, it betrays you, and it just, like, heads over to the opponent's battlefield, and they get the 5-4. So that's a little bit awkward, unless you have the Torpor Orb, in which case you just get a 5-4. That trigger does not happen. There's also Vexing Devils here. I think most of the creatures are lined up on 2 mana, so 1 mana... The 1-mana slot is free for interactions, some Fatal Pushes, some Inquisitions, and a lot of Stubborn Denials as well. I guess leaning into the angle of once you get your monster down, you want to protect it until you can close the game out.
Yeah, this list seems pretty sweet. Torpor Orb is not something that I had really considered using on my own side of the battlefield, but I've certainly used it against some Humans players to great effect. I like the look of this list. This actually looks pretty fun. Stubborn Denial is a hell of a card when you have it active. So,
yeah, it's funny that having 4 main deck Torpor Orbs just automatically hoses a pretty decent chunk of modern decks. Humans is just beginning to touch that number, all the way to Primeval Titans ETB trigger, to Snapcaster Mage, to Ice Fang Coattles. Unfortunately, your opponent's Uros kind of get also powered up just like your Kroxas do. But meanwhile, even like Thought Not Seer has become pretty bad with Torpor Orb out.
Poor Sword of the Meek can't come out of the graveyard.
Yeah, Urza doesn't make a construct. The list goes on.
And this card is just a 2 of in a list, so it's almost an afterthought, but there's 2 copies of Thirst for Knowledge. You know, 2 in a blue would draw 3, and then if you have an artifact, you can discard 1. Otherwise, you discard 2. So what is that doing here? Well, the cards Torpor Orb and Sundial, these are your build-around cards, but you actually don't really ever want the second copy. Like, you really want the first copy, but the second copy doesn't do anything. So I think it's just like a nice sort of deck-building concept from Dr. Huckleberry here to be like, well, I don't just want to be like, I have my nut draw, this is great, and then like the next 2 turns you just draw extra Torpor Orbs, and you're like, oh, okay. At least here you have some chance of like cashing that in for something else. So I think that was a nice angle to cover.
But I mean, imagine if you have a Sundial out, and then your opponent use your Sundial with your Kroxa, and your opponent says, no, I'm going to end your turn, and they play Discontinuity. If you have a second Sundial, you can say, no, I'm going to end my turn with your second Sundial. So I'm sure there's many good reasons to have multiple Sundials in play.
I want to see a screenshot of this. If this happens, I need to see this.
The last line will be like, so-and-so has disconnected from the game. That's the ultimate Sundial.
You mean discontinuity from the game, Dan?
Yes. Exactly. All right, moving on. Talk to me about this list from Bromac Courier.
Yeah, he calls this one Dark Arias. And I got to play against this one. I thought this was pretty slick. It's a low-to-the-ground Rakdos deck. It's built around Aria of Flame. You know, it's got Rakdos staples like Thoughtseize and Lightning Bolt, Fatal Push. But where it gets really interesting is he plays Tainted Remedy and Aria of Flame. So Tainted Remedy, whenever a player would gain life, they lose that much life instead. And Aria of Flame, when it enters the battlefield, your opponent gets an additional 10 life. And so the first time this happened, like, I kind of glanced at Tainted Remedy. I didn't know what it did, really. I, you know, saw him play it, was like, cool, all right. And then he plays Aria of Flame, and suddenly I'm at 10. I was like, wait, what? I should be at 30. What's happening here? And I had to go and like actually reread all of the cards to understand what was happening at that point. But then he plays, you know, a bevy of one drops or one CMC spells, and so that Aria just wrecked me. Although in this particular game, I killed myself, actually. I was activating a Maze Mind Tome, and I got to my fourth counter. Well, Maze Mind Tome's hidden mode is the life gain. I was at 4 life when I activated my Maze Mind Tome on his end step so that I could set up for the next turn, and everybody was very confused when he got the win notification.
I think I was watching you stream that match, and even I like just didn't compute what was happening, because I was like, oh, well, Brian's only at 4, but it's okay. He's got the Maze Mind Tome coming next turn, so he's going to be okay. He's going to gain 4 life back. I was like, oh no, what happened? Why is it going to sideboarding?
Even I didn't notice this, says Dan. The true supreme being when it comes to understanding Maze Mind Tome, Obtain a Remedy interactions. Such confidence.
I just like wasn't, I mean, I just like as an observer, you know, I had one job, which was just to enjoy the match and try to follow what was happening. I didn't even have to make any decisions about playing. But I couldn't even do that.
I think I talked to Bromad about it a little bit too, and even he was like, yeah, I had no idea why you died. It just said I won, and I couldn't figure it out. And I was like, yeah, I didn't realize what I was doing.
Yeah, because it makes my tome, when it goes away, it just exiles, doesn't show up in your graveyard anywhere, so all evidence just gets cleanly erased from the game state.
Yep, yep. So it was a cool interaction. I think the thing that it suffered from is that you've got two combo pieces that are basically at 3 CMC, and you know, getting to that stage in the game where he got to cast one or the other wasn't really so much of a problem for him. You know, he had the Thought Seizes and all of the typical stuff that keeps the coast clear. It's just, it's a little bit slow. So, you know, you give the person, the opponent, a little bit of time to set up their own game plan and things like that. And, you know, if things don't line up quite right, you know, you may have just the Tainted Remedy or just the Aria of Flame. I think in this case, the Aria of Flame is the more powerful card, and what I would want to be casting, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Aria of Flame actually can in theory win on its own in a deck like this with the Lava Darts and just a whole ton of spells, including Metamorphose. Tainted Remedy on its own seems to do basically straight up nothing unless your opponent has life gain, besides the Aria Flame interaction. Of course, if your opponent has a Maze Mind Tome on three counters, you never know what they'll walk into.
Oh, hey, maybe Tainted Remedy is the new tech if we're starting to see a bunch of Uro piles, you know, take top slot in Modern, you know, just pack those Tainted Remedies and watch them slowly kill themselves.
It's the cure for Uro, the remedy for Uro.
There you go.
But I think the biggest problem I have with this deck is what Damon was saying, where it's like, it's a two-card combo, and I think, Brian, you're right to highlight the mana considerations are a little awkward, but the combo itself doesn't actually win, right? The card that wins would actually have already won even if the Tainted Remedies were swapped out for just more cantrips.
Yeah. One comment is that my friend has a Legacy deck built around Kavu Predator, and in Legacy of Exes to Invigorate to give it a +4/+3/+3 at a moment's notice. And so you could, in theory, get redundancy of some sort on the Tainted effect. That would stretch your mana base, and I'm not at all sure this would make this deck better, but something to keep in mind.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to make it a Tainted Remedy deck, unfortunately, those cards like Invigorate, they're not legal in Modern, right? There's these cards that you used to be able to like free cast them if you gave your opponent life. And I don't think there's anything like that in the current card pool.
Yeah. I mean, what we have is Aria of Flame. I wonder what the kind of next best Modern legal contender is.
There's a card called Beacon of Immortality, I think. It doubles the opponent's, or doubles a player's life total. So you could point that at the opponent, but it does cost 6. So that's kind of like the Veto Revival Revenge combo that we kicked around a little bit. But you do it to the opponent. And somehow these cards are even worse than Veto and Revival Revenge. So I'm not sure about that, but I think the Aria angle is very interesting. And that's something that you had highlighted, Brian, as like the promising part of this list going forward.
Yeah, I think Aria is just a super cool card. It was one of the cards that I picked up a playset of immediately when Modern Horizons came out. And I'm actually really shocked that it hasn't seen more play. You know, it was kind of in some of the, is it Phoenix lists or the Grixis Phoenix lists at the time that Phoenix was still doing okay. And other than that, I've really only seen it in like sideboards of Giftstorm, or maybe it makes it into the main deck occasionally as a hedge against, you know, Graveyard Hate or whatever. But yeah, you know, maybe that's just the best shell for it. And, you know, like you guys have said in the past, sometimes some of these cards just get solved, and that's kind of all they end up doing. But it feels like there's more there. It feels like there's some room for exploration.
Yeah, so I think that putting it in a red-black shell is both innovative and a challenge, right? You talked about Giftstorm, Is It Phoenix. Basically, casting a lot of spells is like a blue-red thing, right? Because of the blue cantrips. Now, what Bromad Courier has done is he's dug up some cantrips from black. He's got a couple of Cling to Dust, and he's got a full set of Ransack the Lab, which does cost 2, but it does function to sort of keep the chain going, and then there's Metamorphose as well. So you have, I guess, 10 ish, 10-ish cantrips, and then if you want to include light up the stage, which is a little bit hard to get spectacle on. But there are lava darts here, another great card with Aria of Flame. So if you want to consider that cantrips as well, there is, I think, the possibility of sort of chaining off. But I think that on the whole, this is probably just going to be a not as smooth of a spells shell as the blue-red. I think even when like Jerry Thompson was trying out some like Mardu Phoenix builds, you know, he's a famous lover of Mardu Pyromancer, he tried this and just the problem was just that like the Mardu or black-red colors just never really want to save up their spells. Like they're just trying to cast them as they draw them. And it's hard to sort of chain spells unless you really go out of your way. Which I think that Bromad Courier has done a nice job of attempting that. But there might be more work to do to sort of make it go.
Yeah. The thing with the Phoenix decks is that they play so many cantrips that by turn six or whatever, they may still have seven cards in hand and they cast spells in their cantrips too. And all of a sudden, they not only do they dig through their whole deck at an extremely rapid rate to find the Aria, but by the time they play the Aria, they still have a ton of gas in the tank. Whereas, yeah, as you mentioned, Dan, a black-red shell, you can't really hold on to your Thought Seasons until turn four post-Aria. And you also can't reliably have the Aria on turn three. So I think a kind of a true build around in a red-black shell would be a little tricky.
Gonna have to call up our old friend, the Slapcaster Mage, the Dreadhorde Arcanist. One of the biggest trap cards that I love to go back to.
And some of the cards are extremely good in Legacy. But yeah, I agree that it's a trap card in Modern.
Legacy's a funny place. I like it, but it's funny. It's a little goofy.
I guess you could Finale of Promise in black-red. That'd be okay. And that's three spells. I don't know. Something to think about. On the subject of Aria, you mentioned that we don't see it that often. There was also a cool list from Raytheon in our community league as well that was a Song of Creation deck. Raytheon did use a single Aria of Flame as like an alternate kill condition. So I think maybe just supporting what you're saying about, you know, the Storm strategy enjoys that. But I just want to give a quick shout out to this list because it used Baral Chief of Compliance with a bunch of ritual effects. And then a full playset of Song of Creation. And I was playing against Raytheon, and I had what I thought was a god draw. You know, I had like two Knight of the Ebon Legions and two Thought Seizers or something, and like a Shockland. So I played a Knight of the Ebon Legion on turn one, and then on turn two, I was like, oh, I'll just play a second Knight, Thought Seize them, and then shock myself to like grow both Knights, which is a cool interaction. You know, I lost four life, so both my Knights grow. And then I just died the next turn because, you know, the Thought Seize didn't save me from the combo. Turns out I needed to cast both Thought Seizes on turn two instead of just casting one. It was greedy to not cast both Thought Seizes. I had no idea how much danger I was in, but it's just stunning how fast you can go off with Baral and Rituals and Song of Creation.
Yeah, Song's another wild card that I have spent a lot of time trying to make work. I've done some goofy stuff. My favorite is a list that plays Mirrodin Besieged and a bunch of X casting cost artifact creatures. So you just cast them all for zero and put them in the graveyard. You're filtering through your deck looking for Mox Ambers. The deck also plays Kinnan. And so with Kinnan out, your Mox Ambers are making you two mana, and you build up enough mana to cast your Mirrodin Besieged, and you pick the mode where you win the game if you have 15 artifacts in your graveyard. And so whether you get them there naturally or you have a handful of artifacts when you end the turn with Song, you end up winning until your opponent casts Veil of Summer and you can't target them. It's a tragic loss.
Is the winning targeted? The winning is not targeted.
The winning is actually targeted, yeah. Target opponent loses the game.
Oh my gosh.
It's a balance for multiplayer, Dan.
Yeah.
Okay. Amazing. All right, well, speaking of winning the game, let's talk about this Narset canon list, because this is one of the more interesting, unique, and exciting ways to win, perhaps as early as turn one, question mark?
This one was just is wild. So it starts out, there's 12 lands, 4 City of Brass, 4 Gemstone Cavern, and 4 Gemstone Mine. And then you've got 17 cards with CMC 6 or greater. So just even looking at this list right now, I'm not entirely sure I get it, which is just awesome. This is exactly the kind of list that I love. It looks like what it's trying to do is cast Agorio's Vengeance to put a Narset Enlightened Master onto the battlefield, which will then hopefully land any number of the other big payoffs, such as Brilliant Ultimatum, Fury of the Horde, Enter the Infinite, Emrakul, or Omniscience. It just looks like a total glass cannon. I really like to see it in action.
Yeah, what I find craziest is this thing where the deck uses Serum Powder to basically have some control over exiling initial cards from hand, along with Pull from Eternity, a one white instant, put target face-up card that's removed from the game into its owner's graveyard, to make sure you have access to an early Narset in your graveyard plus a Goryeo's Vengeance to bring it back, to give the deck a weird boost of consistency that I have not really seen in action, and I still am not sure I understand how the kind of probabilities work with mulliganing until you hit a Serum Powder that also has a Narset, in turn mulliganing into a hand that has, or Serum Powdering into a hand that has a Narset plus a Goryeo's Vengeance, or sorry, Pull from Eternity plus Goryeo's Vengeance.
Yeah, I mean, it's a crazy use of these cards, right? Serum Powder, you know, it's such a strong mulligan effect, or before the London Mulligan was a thing, this is what you had to do if you really, really wanted to mulligan. But then, like, making use of the cards in exile, that's, like, really next level. You know, we've seen Eldrazi sometimes do that with Eternal Scourge, but this is, like, we try and exile our key combo pieces so that we can then use another card to, like, put them into the correct zone, which is the graveyard. And it all happens so cheaply. I mean, you can do that off of Gemstone Caverns. You can put Narset into exile off of Gemstone Caverns, Pull from Eternity immediately, and then, you know, with a Simeon Spirit Guide, you're attacking on turn one. Narset Enlightened Master has Hexproof, and it's an attack trigger, so it doesn't even have to connect for damage, right? You just have to get the attack, and then hopefully your top four will have, you know, some of your big payoffs here, whether that's getting another attack step or drawing your entire deck with Enter the Infinite.
Yeah, I don't know how this played out for Ben, but having chatted with them a bunch on Discord about actually that Song of Creation deck I was just talking about and some other combo decks, they are clearly a combo master, so I wouldn't be surprised if this just, you know, did its thing and did it well.
Yeah, you ever get into a mid-range war against somebody who casts a Stomp at you, you can immediately Pull from Eternity their Bonecrusher Giant straight to the graveyard. While also having game against cards like Ancestral Vision or Greater Gargadon combo, when they go to suspend it, kaboom, get pulled down.
Yeah, so I mean, Narset Cannon like has been around for a while, but I think the saddest card in this list is Merchant of the Veil. That obviously used to be Faithless Looting. You know, whenever you're trying to do Goryeo's Vengeance, you want to put the cards in the graveyard, and there's just like no good way to do that anymore. And it's funny because Bin 395 played the same deck the following week in the league, which, Brian, you mentioned some of the weeks we have sort of like fun restrictions, and I think the restriction the following week was that you can play banned cards, but you can only have one copy. So they ran back the same list, but with a single Faithless Looting in the deck.
That's awesome.
See if they could live the dream one last time, but it's so much worse without looting. You know, as like you're saying, it's a 12-land deck. It really, if you draw the Narset, that doesn't help you at all, unless you have like some way to discard it.
Yep. One day, maybe the looting will be unbanned.
But it is not this day. Let's move on to a slightly more fair, well, I say that it's a combo deck as well, a slightly more fair combo deck. Talk to me about Touch the Magic Dragon.
Yeah, so this was a deck by Kilgore Trout. And this is another one with a wild combo that I think I might understand a little bit better than the Narset Cannon, but I love it. It's super cool. So Kilgore is utilizing Possibility Storm to try and cheat out and Enter the Infinite. And the way that he's doing this is by using the sorcery half of Lovestruck Beast. And so once he casts that with a Possibility Storm out, he will go through his deck and hit the Enter the Infinite. Once the Enter the Infinite is out, it looks like what he's looking to do is put a Borborygmos Enraged on top of his library, cast a Singleton Stone Coil Serpent for zero to trigger Possibility Storm again, get the Borborygmos onto the battlefield, and at that point, because he's holding his entire library, he can just start pitching lands and pinging for three. So this, yeah, looks like another Glass Cannon deck. Kind of wild, but the nice thing about this one is it has a really nice backup plan. He's also playing things like Bonecrusher Giant, he's got Glorybringer, Clothis, the Lovestruck Beasts, there's some Magus of the Moon and some Scavenging Ooze in here. And so, you know, the fallback plan here is just a strong red-green mid-range beatdown plan.
Yeah, so Kilgore described this as a port into Modern of the Pioneer Infinite Possibilities deck. which cards you get from Modern? Well, basically Arbor Elf Utopia Sprawl, the core of the Ponza strategy, which I think has proven itself now as a very strong engine. And I've always liked how this deck uses some numbers of Kiora to pair with Glorybringer, although there's only two Glorybringers, which makes me a little sad. But in terms of like your top end, right, this Possibility Storm finish is so crazy. The fact that Enter the Infinite puts a card back just so you don't die from decking. Putting that card back somehow lets you then do the Possibility Storm sequence that you were talking about is just like both elegant and just like super clever. The trouble that I have with the list is that you never really want to draw Enter the Infinite. So you just want to put one copy in the deck. Data with shared summons. That's, you know, if you draw the Bonecrusher Giant, you want to get shared summons. But the only times you ever want that is to Possibility Storm into it. So if you happen to draw these cards naturally, you just like don't have the combo available anymore. Like if you ever draw Enter the Infinite, you're not going to do the combo that game. And that's a little disappointing. I guess put a Utopia Sprawl on blue, but even then, probably not.
Yeah, Enter the Infinite is not meant to be hard cast. It's just what it comes down to. But that said, I know that like the Neobrand decks have a similar problem with Gristlebrand, where if they draw their Gristlebrand, they just are out of luck. They lose that game, sort of. Allosaurus Rider beatdown. But they used to run two, and now they run one, and they just accept those odds.
Really? I thought they only ran two. I've never seen it with one.
I think they used to. I think it's down to one now. We'll have to pull up a list.
Live Dangerously.
Yeah, I mean, it's a combo deck. That's kind of just the name of the game, really. You can reduce the danger of drawing two Gristlebrand or drawing a Gristlebrand if you only have a two, but it also increases the chances you draw the Gristlebrand in the first place, which is just a dead draw.
So the other thing that this deck can do, which is a little more chaotic, is that you can just play Possibility Storm without the rest of the combo, you know, without an adventure creature, and just see what happens.
Spin the wheel.
Then both players, are just playing with this Possibility Storm effect, and, you know, maybe you'll win.
I had that happen in a match once, and it was, like, one of the most fun games of competitive Magic I've had, where it just was not clear what was going to happen.
I mean, game plans go out the window at that point, right? There's no real accounting for anything unless you have a very particular deck where you know what your hits are going to be, and I feel like poker players or other people who are used to keeping track of odds in their head are probably at an advantage there.
As are players with Teferi Time Raveler in their deck.
Oh, yeah. Yep, that's a big one. Yeah.
But yeah, I think Neobrand is down to one Gristlebrand, Dan. So this is just a combo player's risk.
All right.
That is acceptable. Not that Neobrand's really been putting up too many prominent results to really justify it, but this does seem like what they converged on.
My heart can't take all the excitement from just having a one of in the list.
Every draw step could be your last. It's like a Russian roulette with a slightly larger chamber.
Live by the Gristlebrand, die by the Gristlebrand.
So it was wild to think that Possibility Storm is like stuck around for so long. I mean, we've talked about this shell before because it did 5-0 a few times when Pioneer was pretty new as a format. And then, of course, there's the Jeskai Possibility Storm build as well. I think Lawson talked about that when he was on. And this is just a cool approach to sort of see what it can do with like things that the faster, better mana available in Modern. So nice take here by Kilgore Trout. Moving into the Grixis colors, we have a deck from Ill, Sick, Nasty, described as Grixis Pile.
Yeah, so this one speaks to me on a couple of levels. So first of all, it's full of artifacts that can be recurred with Emery or Lurrus, and I'm already in right there. But it looks to exploit an interaction between two cards that I haven't really seen paired together before, and that's Gadrak, the Crown Scourge, which is a 3 CMC 5/4 flyer that can't attack unless you've got four artifacts on the field. But it has a trigger that'll create a number of treasure tokens on your end step equal to the number of non-token creatures that died this turn. And so Kroxa is a card that you can cast. It'll ETB, it'll sacrifice itself and go to the graveyard. And that synergy seems pretty sweet to me. So you're getting a little bit of extra value out of your Kroxa. If you already have your four artifacts on the battlefield for Gadrak, you're basically getting a one mana cost reduction. And if you don't, you're getting an artifact to contribute towards getting your Gadrak online for attacking. Yeah, I think I would actually like to explore this interaction a little bit more. I haven't taken the list through any leagues yet, but I've been kind of toying around with Gadrick and some Wurza lists and trying to see if he's a decent alternate win con. The other interesting synergy here is using Lazav, the Multifarious, to copy Kroxa. And, you know, I think we've seen that before. As you had said earlier, you know, we've kind of looked at copying some of the Titans before. But I think that in general, I'm interested in Lazav. I think he's been kind of underutilized. You know, I think that there's some shenanigans that he could get up to copying some other legendary creatures in particular. So one of the ideas that I had was copying a Zerda, for example. So if you end up with two Zerdas on the field, you know, you've reduced the activated cost of, say, Kinnan to 3 or Urza to 1. And if you have an Urza in play and can activate it for 1 mana, I can't see how you would lose that game. That's, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would be insane. 1 mana Urza activations.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess this list could play Urza if you really wanted to go that route. It's weird that there's, I guess this is by design, it's a Mox Amber deck, 4 Mox Ambers, because most of the creatures here happen to be legendary. There's Gadrak, there's Emry, Lazav, Kroxa, there's even 3 Lures of the Dream Den to support the Mistress Bauble angle. I guess Urza is also legendary, and so is Zerda.
Yeah.
And so is Hope of Ghirapur, but it doesn't have a color for Mox Amber.
No, sadly.
Sad story.
I think that interaction you're talking about with, you know, getting a treasure off Kroxa, when Kroxa dies, Gadrak will give you the treasure for that. And then you can then spend the treasure to recast Kroxa. That's something that I think is pretty sweet with Gadrak, is that if you're looking at it as, okay, here's the hoop I have to jump through to attack. You know, it's 5/4 flying for 3, but you can't attack until you get 4 artifacts. So that just sounds like it's not worth it, right? The juice is not worth the squeeze, as David would say, if all I'm trying to do is attack with a 5/4 flyer. But the treasures are worth more than just letting you attack with a random creature, right? A treasure is mana, they're lotus petals. And as long as you're constructing your deck in such a way that it has things to do, you could potentially get some really explosive turns out of, you know, having extra treasures lying around. And, you know, Kroxa and Lazav, these are nice ways to have extra things to do. There's even Galvanic Blast here, so your extra treasures from Gadrak become Metalcraft enablers. It's very clever construction.
Yeah, absolutely. And hey, if you want to get real out there with it, you can use those treasures to power up your Revel in Riches and win with, you know, some real jank, or play your Marionette Masters and, you know, sacrifice them to dome your opponent.
We're trying to make the next ideas try to make it better, not more meme-ish, I think.
Yeah.
Or maybe both.
People do play Negate, you know. We can't just go throwing Revel in Riches into any deck.
I know, that's true.
I have a soft spot for that card. That was one of the cards when I was when I first got back into Magic. I was primarily playing Limited, and I don't know how or why I would have ever drafted that card, but I ended up with one in my possession. So when I started building constructed decks, I was pretty determined to make it work. Sadly, those dreams were never realized.
So is it crazy for me to want to put Cat Oven into this deck? Thinking about the artifact theme, you know, a treasure token and a food token, they're kind of playing in similar space. There's an Emry self-mill theme, Lazav surveilling. So you could just put the cat in the graveyard that way. And then if you ever get Oven and Kroxa, that's two foods.
Yeah, you know, I don't have a lot of experience playing Cat Oven. I have put the Oven into a couple of lists I've played, and it's always performed a lot better than I expected. You know, I tended to put it in lists with Psy, and Psy having 4 toughness meant that if I ever, you know, if Psy was going to eat a removal spell, I could turn him into 2 foods, and those food tokens actually end up being bigger game than I expected. You know, drawing the life isn't insignificant, and in these decks that want a high density of artifacts, it's a really great way to just produce artifacts. And like you said, you know, with Kroxa, it's kind of a free roll. There's really little downside to it, so.
Yeah, the one hesitation I have with that, Dan, is just that, you know, in Standard, for example, this effect of Cat Oven was so good, or actually so annoying, it got banned. But modern matches are much less often defined by creature combat or small amounts of life total to swings.
Right. I think once you are looking at the Kaedavan package, you're moving away from modern power levels. So maybe this would be like for a pioneer version of the deck, where you know you wouldn't have Lurrus Bauble, for example. So you could free up some slots for a different engine. It'd be a little weaker, but it would work maybe in the same space.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think my initial thought would be to just cut the Necrogen spell bombs. I've tried playing with those a couple of times, and they're just slightly too slow. Like, every time I just want it to be a Thoughtseize instead. So, you know, something to consider. But, yeah, I think I agree with Damon on this one. The Kaedavan's probably not quite modern power level.
Yeah, I mean, the Necrogen spell bomb is like a win condition with Lurrus, kind of. But
people were running it for a while. And then they stopped, even when Lurrus was just a companion. It just didn't quite seem to be good enough somehow. Seal of Fire was like just really good with Lurrus, but in a way the Necrogen Spellbomb didn't quite meet.
I think if the Necrogen was more like a Nihil Spellbomb, where you could pay to draw while also getting the benefit from it, you know, the discard, I think then it would be a lot better. But the fact that you have to choose between the draw and the discard makes it just slightly worse. You know, I would rather be looping the like Chromatic Stars for my card draw than recasting a Necrogen spell bomb and then activating it to draw. So
I mean, if it were like that, it would be like the best, not the best. It would be insane if you could get the discard and the draw at the same time. That'd be so good.
Yeah, the perpetual problem of artifacts. They're always slightly overcosted, and I understand why. It makes sense, but...
Integers, man. It's throwing everything off.
Exactly, Dan. I'm glad you understand. Up next, we have a sort of green-blue devotion list coming from Red Trex. And by devotion, I mean that this list uses two cards that, together at least, are too good for Pioneer in the form of Leyline of Abundance as a 4-of, which makes your creatures tap for an additional green mana, and also Nykthos Shrine to Nyx, which leverages the two green pips you can get for free off Leyline of Abundance. In addition to this, we get a whole host of green 1-drops in the form of Birds of Paradise, Landwar Elves, Noble Hierarch. No surprises there. Along with Kinnan, who can also amplify the mana you get from these cards. And then in turn, what do we do with this mana? Well, there's a whole number of cards this deck leverages. One is the classic Hydroid Krasis. Two is Nissa Who Shakes the World to ramp into, who in turn makes your mana even larger. And Nissa plus Hydroid Krasis is a strategy we know and love from Standard, or perhaps know and despise at this point. We have a couple Prime Times, and we have a 4 Karn the Great Creator, which is just a classic way to use a whole bunch of mana in the form of what you can do when you play Karn. In this week of the league, we're actually playing where banned cards were treated as restricted, which meant you could use Karn to get the once Modern Terror Microsoft Lettuce or Microsynth Lattice and use that to lock the opponents out with Karn the Great Creator. And so if you have 10 mana, this is kind of like a one-hit KO unless your opponent is pretty far ahead on board.
Yeah, so obviously that angle is less relevant outside of the specific conditions of the week, but I think Red T-Rex sort of saw that as an excuse to ask a more sort of fundamental question of like, how good is this mono green planeswalker strategy? Is it good enough that you could sort of take it into modern and still find success there? And what exactly is the power up that you get from the modern card pool? Because right, I'm looking down the list and it's like, okay, Birds of Paradise, Noble Hierarch, those might as well just be Llanowar Elves and Elvish Mystic. Not necessarily a huge upgrade there. The rest of these cards, I mean, Karn and Nissa, that's the core of the Pioneer deck as well. So it's really just like the Leyline of Abundance, and I guess there's Primeval Titan on top, I guess. One of the best modern cards of all time. But like, is this actually, you know, have we appropriately powered up to sort of scale with a jump from Pioneer to Modern?
Yeah, it's not clear to me that the Primeval Titan is really all that necessary. There are 2 Field of the Dead in this list, but even so, I feel like the Prime Time is actually one of the weaker things going on in this list. I don't know. I think that probably the scariest thing would be one of these Hydroid Krasis. I imagine that he was making, you know, 80 mana a turn or something obscene like that at some point. yeah, I'm really curious to know how this one played out. I've always been a little bit afraid of playing mana dorks. When I was first getting into Modern, I picked up a deck by a Redditor Deuil. I don't know exactly how to pronounce it, but he's done a couple write-ups on the Modern subreddit for his deck Mono Green Control, and it plays things like Trinisphere and Plow Under and Primal Command to just kind of lock the opponent out of being able to cast spells. And so I got, you know, really used to turn one mana dork and my mana dork dying. So I think my hesitation with this would be that it's so heavy on the mana dorks. You know, I see Kinnan, and I think that I, you know, personally, I'm a lot more interested in artifact mana producers, even things like Chromatic Sphere and Chromatic Star go mana positive with Kinnan out. And so, you know, I think I would personally be looking in that direction, but at the same time, when you've got your Ley Line of Abundance, that only works with your creatures, and the Ley Line of Abundance can also become a win con with any of these just by activating it. So I'm kind of curious to know how some of these games played out.
Yeah, I mean, this might just be a pretty sick meta read in the sense that first off, there's four Veil of Summer in the sideboard, so that if you're worried about the black decks featuring a bunch of Fatal Pushes, you have that covered. And meanwhile, I wouldn't walk into our community league expecting to face a bunch of blue-white control featuring Supreme Verdicts to wipe away your elves.
Yeah, that's fair.
So talk to me about Leyline of Abundance. Yeah, how good is that card? I've seen it in Modern in like maybe some elf strategies if someone's trying to get fancy with like an Umbral Mantle, Devoted Druid combo or something. I mean, it does have some possibilities there. In Pioneer, it got banned right off the bat because it was just like a great enabler for Nykthos. And here, this is a Nykthos deck.
Well, that's slightly revisionist, Dan. It wasn't banned right off the bat. It was in the format for at least several weeks, and the deck was dominant.
Right off the bat in the sense that it was in the first round of bans.
Sure, sure. It was banned quite quickly, but believe me, it proved itself in Pioneer quite quickly.
Yeah, I haven't really played with it myself. I looking at the card text, my inclination would actually be to look at how we could reduce the cost on the activated ability, but I think I have an interest in Zerta that powers that one. Yeah, I am really curious how often the adding a 1/1 counter would come up as a way to finish a game. You know, with so many mana dorks, you can snowball pretty quickly into emptying your hand. And then if you cast a Hydroid Krasis, you know, you may draw another handful of mana dorks, but with all the mana, you can just dump them. And so you may have this really small go wide army or a wide army of 1/1s or 0/1s. And so being able to pump them up seems like it might actually be an effective strategy to getting over the line.
Yeah, in my limited experience with Leyline in Modern, that doesn't really come up. I mean, I think I've won one game that way, or 1.5 games. If I could be more imprecise, if I'm not limited to integers, it was actually 1.5 games that I won with that. But like, it's just like not enough of a payoff to like be like, oh, I have everything I need. Like, what you actually need is the card of the Nissa or the Krasis or whatever. Like, those are the cards that will win. And here it's like, yeah, a card will win the game. A Nissa will win. The ley line itself is probably not going to win, but it's interesting.
I view it as about 10 times better than Kinnan's activated ability, where they both provide a very slight upside to the card, but Kinnan's upside is just very rarely used, and Leyline of Abundance is 10 times more than rarely, which is still rarely, but it is a thing I've seen.
Although this is a deck where you might want to activate Kinnan. I mean, you can put a non-human creature from your top five, and this can find Uro, this can find Primeval Titan.
Oh, hell yeah, you can hit a Hydroid Krasis.
Or Hydroid Krasis. Take out the opposing Bridge from Below's, right? But yeah, finding a Titan off Kinnan would be pretty sweet, and then get your Field of the Deads that way.
I have activated Kinnan a number of times in a deck with four Uros, and I've never hit the Uro, so I've been burned on that particular interaction a couple of times. I don't know that I'd be keen on trying it again.
Fair enough. Last question. Do you think that if you're playing Leyline, do you think you need to play Dryad Arbors? Or is that card just too bad?
Well, in Modern, you actually have access to fetch lands to find the Dryad Arbor to give you consistency on that. So that's an interesting question, Dan.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I tend to think of Dryad Arbor as a protection spell almost. You know, you're going to get hit with a Liliana downtick and you just need something else to sacrifice. So you fetch in response and, you know, go get your Dryad Arbor to sacrifice it. But yeah, in this, I mean, it would be a much bigger mana producer, so...
That said, I play a lot of Legacy Maverick, which plays a one of Dryad Arbor as a Green Sun Zenith target, where that basically turns Green Sun Zenith into a split card Llanowar Elf or Knight of the Reliquary. And trust me, there are a lot of hands where you have a Dryad Arbor in them, and every time you open the hand with that card, you're like, oh, this hand sucks. it really is just a very sad, sad turn one play or turn two play or turn three play. Anytime you play it from hand, the fact that it doesn't have haste, so you have a Summoning Sick land, and then all of a sudden your opponent's Lightning Bolts are wastelands, and their wastelands are wastelands, can lead to some really damaging starts.
Yeah. But the upside here is that it can turn a fetch land into, you know, a Dryad Arbor will now tap for like three if you have a kin in a ley line now. It's, you know, that'd be so sweet.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I'm not totally dismissing it.
Well, and this list is actually kind of land light for a Primeval Titan Uro deck, only running 23 lands, so maybe that's one area, like, beef up the land count a little bit. Doesn't hurt to include one. I don't know what I'd be looking to cut exactly. Maybe the Primeval Titans, I think that's actually kind of the weakest creature here, because... I don't know, I suppose you fetch your Field of the Dead and then you fetch some fuel for it, but there's nothing else really in here, maybe the Nykthos, that you're super eager to get.
On the other hand, the deck has a total of approximately 16 spells that can close the game out on their own, depending on how you count Llanowar Elves. And so you can't really trim the gas too much, and you can't really trim the mana dorks. So I kind of feel like the land count is in about the right spot, especially because this deck is... not just using the elves to ramp in a one-for-one way where, you know, one Llanowar Elves counts the same as one forest, but here with the Kinnons and the Ley Lines, one Llanowar Elves counts for several forests.
Yeah, so it's actually like a straightforward-ish strategy, but, you know, there's a lot of questions that it raises, both about, you know, what can we add to take it to Modern, or, like, we haven't even talked about the blue splash. Like, the Pioneer deck could splash blue if it wanted to. You know, Kinnon would fit, Uro would fit if you thought those were going to be upgrades, but that has a whole can of worms. It's a lot of complications to the mana base doing that. So, yeah, we'll post a list. I mean, it's an interesting thought experiment, for sure.
Yeah.
That being said, all the lists that we just discussed, we will put in the show notes. If you want to see decks like this, a lot more decks like this in action, signups are underway right now, I think, for the next Community League. Is that right, Brian?
That is correct. They will be up through Sunday, and then pairings will go up probably on Monday.
Just a friendly thing, free to join, but it's just awesome to see a lot of creativity at work and, you know, get some fresh inspiration for your next 5-0, as we say.
Yeah, I mean, don't let your memes not be dreams. Exactly. How does that work?
Exactly. We're still working on these taglines, but...
It's only season 3. We have plenty of time.
All right. So, Brian, thanks so much for coming on and talking through some of these lists with us. And thanks so much for setting up these leagues. It's been a huge boon. It's been a ton of fun. I gotta ask, where can people find you online?
I am somewhat of an online lurker, but I do pop into Reddit. Sometimes you'll find me on the Modern or the Pioneer subreddits, typically trying to answer questions and, you know, help others out. I go by Untwisted pretty much all over the internet. I also have Twitter, Untwisted_MTG. Like I said, I tend to be a little bit more of a lurker, but hopefully you'll be hearing some more out of me. Some fellow faithless family members, Jiggy Wiggy and Mana Symbol, and I are working on our own little podcast. So hopefully we'll have an episode of that coming out in the next couple of weeks.
I am super excited for that podcast. We've had Zach on a couple times, and... that's like the brewing brain trust right there. I don't know what you're going to talk about, but I'm definitely going to be tuning in as soon as it's ready.
Well, I think it was David that brought up the quote by some basketball coach about not having too many knuckleheads on a team. And I think this podcast is going to be an exercise in fitting three knuckleheads in a team that can really only support one. I expect a lot of burned ticks and a lot of absolutely wild ideas.
Sounds like it'll be a fun time.
Pat Riley's worst nightmare. His dream became a meme. The Three Knuckleheads podcast. All right. We'll be on the lookout for that, eagerly awaiting that.
Yeah. I just have one last question about Community League, and that's, I guess, for the season two. Who came the closest to winning but didn't quite win? You know, I'm curious about this question.
Oh, you know, all of our historical data was tragically lost. No, it was... yeah, Dan came in second. Okay. You did come in first.
Wow. Congratulations, Dan. You almost won.
First loser.
Just for some context, by the way, Dan and I grew up next door neighbors, and at some point I looked back at our, when you still could, our MTG records head-to-head on the Wizards record-keeping site, which is just tragically lost forever, and I didn't win a single match against Dan, so I have to trash talk whenever I have these opportunities.
That's amazing. I feel like you must have let me win or something just because I was older, which was the correct decision.
You always won. You always won. And then at GP Columbus, you came in 41st. I came in 42nd. And so I have to cherish these moments when they happen.
Well, that's because when we were kids, I was smarter and faster than you. But now it's all reversed. You know? But nowadays, I mean, you know, you're just running circles around me. So.
I wouldn't go that far, even if in this community league I did.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to call it here. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We will be back with our regularly scheduled episode, probably just a couple days after hearing this one. So a little bonus content for you. Brian, thanks so much for being on the cast, and we'll be seeing you around the Discord and around the leagues.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it was great chatting.
It's a pleasure. All right. That's it, everyone. Take care, stay safe, and happy brewing.